Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Janat Jalil, and I'm here to introduce you to The Global Story, a podcast which brings you a single story in depth with insight from the BBC's best journalists. There's a new edition every weekday. Just search for The Global Story wherever you get your podcasts and be sure to subscribe so you don't miss a single episode. Here's my colleague, Katrina Perry.
Today, the rapid rise of Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. After ruthlessly outmaneuvering hundreds of rivals, MBS became next in line to the throne and the most powerful man in Saudi Arabia. He believes his sweeping vision for the country will bring in investment, top-flight sport, and visitors from around the world. His only demand in return, absolute loyalty.
Can anything stop you?
Only death.
So where does he want to take the country? And is he truly unstoppable? Our guests today, Jonathan Rugman, a journalist and producer of a new two-part documentary that tells the story of MBS, The Kingdom, the World's Most Powerful Prince. Hi, Jonathan.
Hi.
And Sebastian Usher, the BBC's Arab Affairs editor. Hi, Sebastian.
Hi there.
Just how powerful is MBS in Saudi Arabia in 2024? Officially, what is his role, Sebastian?
Well, he's the Crown Prince, so he's the next in line to his father, King Salman. And he's also been made the Prime Minister, which, I mean, in the system that Saudi Arabia has, is not the most important, but it gives him an extra kind of credibility. And it's often the way that he's referred to by his supporters. He's essentially de facto ruler of Saudi Arabia and has been pretty much for the past, the last six, seven, 8 years or so. I mean, although it wasn't formalized, and to some extent it still isn't quite, when foreign leaders go to Saudi Arabia now, they very much do go to meet him. I mean, he is the man who calls the shots in Saudi Arabia. So yes, his power is immense.
And Sebastian, although Saudi Arabia is a monarchy, it doesn't work strictly in the same way as many monarchies that we're familiar with work, does it?
No, I mean, the system that evolved after the death of Ibn Saud, the founder of the modern Saudi, I mean, it did go down to his son. King Saud was the first son after he died. But since then, it was his brothers who succeeded him. And it was essentially a succession system in which the older brother was supposed to be the next one. These all being the sons of Ibn Saud. Of course, he had more than 40 officially recognized sons. And, you know, although it went to the older brother, there were changes within that where some brothers were essentially stepped over because they weren't seen as up to the job. So it's a system which wasn't really formalized in any way, but it didn't involve the direct succession of the sons of the current king. And that successor would move into position as crown prince. Essentially, that's the position from which it's expected that the next king would come.
And Jonathan, if we're trying to understand that power and just who Mohammed bin Salman is, you've been reporting on his rise to power. Help us understand just how rapid or how unexpected that was. Take us back to where it all began, where he was born, his position in the royal family.
He really is the kid least likely to succeed if you go back and look at the history of Mohammed bin Salman or MBS, in the sense that he had several brothers, many of whom were quite distinguished. One was the first Muslim to become a NASA astronaut. Another got a PhD from Oxford University. And MBS didn't leave the kingdom. He was educated at home. By all accounts, he wasn't a keen student. He preferred playing with the palace guards. But he emerged as his father's favorite. And what happened was that two previous crown princes died in quick succession in 2011 and 2012. And suddenly, Prince Salman, MBS's father, becomes the next crown prince and therefore the most likely next heir. And he looks around at his sons and he chooses MBS over the other brothers to be the one who is going to help him. His father is not only crown prince, but also defense minister, and MBS is constantly at his side. And MBS, I mean, it's interesting to think about why he chose MBS, possibly because he reminded him of himself as a kind of rather rough-hewn warrior-like figure, perhaps a bit of a throwback to the founder of the modern kingdom of Saudi Arabia. But also, he's a grafter. He works hard. He's keen to learn. And in a kingdom where many thousands of princes are accused of being pampered playboys, this is a young man who's really, really on the make and determined that his father should become king and that he should become king one day himself.
And speaking of that evolution, Jonathan, you've been speaking to people who claim that MBS went to quite extraordinary lengths to ensure that the crown would pass to his father and coming in his own direction then, even targeting one of his uncles.
Yes, that's right. I mean, the sad fact is that King Salman, who's now in his mid to late 80s, is suffering from what's believed to be a form of dementia. And in 2014, we heard from a very good source that MBS was so worried that his father's illness would become too obvious, that his father would not be allowed to become king.
I was in the ministry that night. The office of Mohammed bin Nayef called me and said, "Saad, don't leave. There is a CD you need to watch."
The source we spoke to is a man called Saad al-Jabri, who was the chief of staff for the Saudi interior minister. He's the most senior Saudi dissident to have spoken about the inner workings of MBS's royal court. And he told us that he had a video recording that he had seen, because there's a lot of internal spying that goes on between different factions, different princes. And that he had this video recording of MBS and a man called MBN, Mohammed bin Nayef, who was the interior minister at the time.
MBS is sitting with Prince Mohammed bin Nayef in his office. He was tense. He told him that I had a ring, a poisoning ring.
He had this poisoned ring in order to poison the monarch at the time so that his father could take over.
It's enough to kill the guy if we just shake hand with him, and I'm willing to go to the king and shake the hand with him. I must say here that I don't know for sure whether he was serious or just bragging that or showing off in front of his cousin, but we took it seriously.
It was taken seriously enough for MBS to be banned from court for a while and to be prevented from shaking hands with the king, his own uncle. And I think it's just a story, one of many stories, which demonstrates the extraordinary, rampant and dangerous ambition that MBS has at every turn, both to take power and ultimately to keep it.
And even once his father had become crown prince and next in line to the throne, it still, as we've been discussing, that evolution wasn't certain that MBS himself would automatically follow on. Your reporting shows that major global events were influenced by him trying to build out his own reputation, his own platform, the war in Yemen being a case in point.
Yes, I mean, in 2015, his father becomes king. MBS is defence minister. He's just 29 years old. He has no military experience. And what does he do? A couple of months into his father's reign, he leads a coalition, a Gulf coalition, into war against the Houthis in Yemen, who have usurped the UN-recognized leader of the country. And this is quickly and widely decried as a complete disaster. There's currently a ceasefire between the Houthis in Yemen and Saudi Arabia, but not before hundreds of thousands of people haven't died or been killed. And this was really the first big mistake that MBS made.
We started the war in March, and MBS was pushing towards ground intervention. MBN, who was crown prince, he said no.
Saad al-Jabri, who was the chief of staff of the interior minister, told us MBS had forged his father the king's signature in order to authorize the use of ground troops.
We heard from some people around MBS that he forged the signature of his dad for that royal decree.
And this revelation, we didn't know that this was the case.
Later on, we were surprised that there was a royal decree to allow the ground interventions.
Now, it's important to say that ground troops weren't the decisive factor in the Yemen war, and that the Saudis, who haven't responded to our request for answers to some of these allegations, but what I would say on their behalf, I think, is that they would deny it. They would say that the king wrote his own official decrees and that MBS would not have done that.
And it's interesting the point you make about whether it impacted MBS' reputation or not, because there was that point, Jonathan, where his father had to decide whether to pass the crown to his son or to his cousin, Mohammed bin Nayef. And Donald Trump's administration actually played a role in helping MBS to build out his stature, his position at that time. Tell us about that.
Well, I think with the benefit of hindsight, we should have all seen that MBS was the once and future king. But a lot of Arab watchers, a lot of Saudi watchers did get it wrong. They assumed that the crown prince at the time, Mohammed bin Nayef, would succeed King Salman. And Mohammed bin Nayef was a key friend of the CIA and MI6 in combating al-Qaeda terrorist plots. He helped save hundreds, if not thousands, of lives in the West. So this guy was very much the MI6 and the CIA's man, and they wanted him to become king. But instead, in the summer of 2017, he was invited to a meeting with MBS.
His phone was taken away from him. His guards were dismissed, and he was in a room, and there was someone in that room who was trying to convince him that he had to willingly give up the crown princeship.
We spoke to Professor Bernard Heichel, who teaches at Princeton in the US, and he's a friend of MBS. Mohammed bin Nayef, his rival, the previous crown prince, was known to be addicted to pain-killing drugs because he had been badly injured in an al-Qaeda attack.
He was effectively told if he didn't do this willingly, there would be consequences to him, and he could do this either through a formal way or it could be done in a way that would be, again, deeply troubling and embarrassing for him.
And I guess the point about Donald Trump in all this is that in the meantime, while this was all going on, Donald Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, had become friends with MBS. And it was like one princeling from one dynastic family talking to another. So they would play video games together, they would WhatsApp each other. So essentially, everything that MBS did was unofficially underwritten by the Trump administration. And Mohammed bin Nayef was arrested. He has not been heard from for several years. And remember, this was the crown prince of Saudi Arabia. And this sets a pattern, I think, of MBS systematically shutting down all avenues of opposition. And instead, what MBS has done is forged a new constituency of his own amongst young people in Saudi Arabia by giving them access to cinemas and concerts and the freedom to men and women to mingle together.
So, Sebastian, when we put all those pieces of the puzzle together and we're looking at the image of Mohammed bin Salman, who is he? What does it tell us?
Well, I think the defining image still, for many, he is seen as a man, not only who could use these incredibly strong-arm tactics against his potential opponents, but if you talk to people here about Saudi Arabia, many people, you know, in the US and around, that's how they see it, still as a kind of pariah state. But when you're there in Saudi Arabia, I mean, I lived there for a time in the 90s. It is like day and night how it is now to how it was then. Then the morality police were on the streets. They were controlling the way people dressed, the way they communicated with each other, the division between men and women, all of these strictures on the way that people could live, the ban on women driving, for example, being one of them. These have been turned around. And the power of the very strict clerical establishment has been almost entirely taken away from them. It is a real change. You see it when you walk the streets of Saudi Arabia, when you go anywhere, and the way, for example, that men and women interact now, to me is extraordinary, having experienced it, you know, 15, 20 years ago, when the taboos were so strong, to see how easily it seems this new generation to live in a way that was completely alien to their parents. Many of them have a very strong respect for MBS. They see him as someone who's prioritized their generation, their needs and their desires. Because, I mean, what he's trying to do to an extent, he wants to find a way to wean the economy off oil. So, you know, through the tourism sector, through all sorts of other new ways of making money for the Saudis. Obviously, what he hasn't done is give them any political space whatsoever independently to navigate down there. And there are still extraordinary prison sentences given to people who are seen as stepping out of line in even the slightest way.
So, Sebastian, you're outlining there this vision that MBS has for Saudi Arabia, the economy and so on.
So, ladies and gentlemen, we move to the Leonardo da Vinci, the Salvatore Mundi, the masterpiece.
But Jonathan, nothing quite gives insight into the ambition that he has for the country than that purchase of a painting, the Salvatore Mundi.
At $370 million, ladies and gentlemen. $400 million!
Yes, the story goes like this. In 2017, a Saudi prince bid an astonishing $450 million for a painting called the Salvatore Mundi at Christie's auction house in New York. It's the most expensive work of art ever sold. And nobody has seen this painting ever since, so not for 7 years. And we spoke to a friend of the Crown Prince, Professor Bernard Haykel, and he told us that the painting was in storage in Geneva. He confirmed that it had been bought on behalf of MBS himself.
When I asked about it, MBS said, "Do you know how many people visit the Louvre?" I said, "Tens of millions in Paris." He says, "Do you know that 90% visit the Louvre just to see one object? And do you know what that object is?" I said, "Well, it's probably the Mona Lisa, right?" He said, "Yeah, that's right."
And he quoted MBS as saying that the painting would be displayed in Riyadh, the capital.
So he said, "I want to build a very large museum in Riyadh, and I want an anchor object that will attract people, just like the Mona Lisa."
I think it speaks to his ambition to play the West at its own game, really, in conspicuous displays of power, which will, in MBS's mind, turn Saudi Arabia into a major tourist destination. So we've seen the purchase of Newcastle United in the Premier League, Cristiano Ronaldo playing his soccer in Saudi Arabia for hundreds of millions of dollars a year. I'm not sure he really cares that much about what people think in the West of him. I think he's much more interested in portraying his own power, actually doing the opposite of sports washing and actually saying to the rest of the world, "You can say what you like about me, but I've got the money, I've got the power, and I can buy what I want."
So Mohammed bin Salman has a bold vision for Saudi Arabia and the power to put it into action. But alongside those headlines that were received well in the West, we also hear stories of free speech being suppressed. Next, just how far will he go to hold on to power? This is The Global Story from the BBC World Service. Please do look us up wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe so that you don't miss a fresh global story each weekday. So I'm joined today by Jonathan Rugman and Sebastian Usher. Alongside those headlines that we've been discussing that MBS might have welcomed and the efforts he's making for the country, there are more troubling stories linked to his regime.
I opened my phone and checked the consulate, the working time. And it was saying that the consulate already closed.
In October 2018, journalist Jamal Khashoggi entered the Saudi consulate in Istanbul and was never seen alive again. This was his fiancée speaking to the BBC.
And then I called the consulate. He said there is no one inside. And then I got really scared. "Where is Jamal? What happened to Jamal?"
Despite attempts by the Saudi government to cover it up, we now know that he was murdered in the consulate. And amid international outcry, MBS was forced to acknowledge the incident.
Did you order the murder of Jamal Khashoggi?
Absolutely not. This was a heinous crime. But I take full responsibility as a leader in Saudi Arabia.
And what's incredible from your reporting, Jonathan, is that this may not have been the only attempted assassination.
Yes, that's right. We spoke to Saad al-Jabri, who's the most senior Saudi dissident to have fled the kingdom and to have been prepared to speak to us. And he has alleged in court documents that 2 weeks after the murder of Jamal Khashoggi in Istanbul, another Saudi hit squad was deployed to Canada in an attempt either to kill or to bring him back to Saudi Arabia.
He planned for my assassination. There is no question about the motive. MBS sees me as a threat to him, and he will not rest off until he sees me dead.
And the Canadians have certainly not denied that this happened. As far as we know, the hit squad was turned back.
Does he live in fear of something similar being repeated?
Yes, he does. I met him in three countries. I spent a lot of time with him trying to build up his confidence to talk about what he knows. And what he knows is a great deal. Two of his children are being held against their will in Saudi Arabia. They're not allowed to join him in Canada. And he believes that they're being held as some sort of insurance policy to try and prevent him from speaking out any further. But yes, he is convinced that MBS is going to try and kill him.
Well, let's talk about that international side of things for a moment. Sebastian, what has been the impact of the events we've been discussing, the death of Jamal Khashoggi, the crackdown on internal dissent?
You know, as we've been saying, it still very much colours the image of not just MBS, but I think of Saudi Arabia itself. Saudi Arabia has made clear under MBS that, yes, it's still a close ally of the US, but that it will also cozy up to China, to Russia, to whatever essentially MBS and the people who advise him feel is in the interest of Saudi Arabia. And it is in a very, very strong position where it's needed in order for the world economy to continue, particularly with the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. I think the world, I think the US, are looking to Saudi Arabia to be the power in the Arab world that may, when and if the war in Gaza ends, to be trying to secure some sort of future that is livable for the Palestinians and, I guess, for the Israelis too.
So MBS has become the most powerful man in Saudi Arabia and embarked on reshaping the country in this bold new vision as we've been discussing. Jonathan, the investigative journalist Karim Zidane told you that this formed the basis of a new social contract.
The social contract says this: I'm going to give you everything you have always desired. All I ask from you is that you never mention politics, you never criticize me or what I am doing.
But what is standing in his way? How secure is that social contract? Does he face any challenges at home?
Well, Saudi Arabia will remain an absolute monarchy as it always has been for the foreseeable future. I think the lesson from the Arab Spring revolutions that began in 2011 is that democracy can be a very dangerous thing, and the Saudi royal family will do all it can to prevent it from coming to Saudi Arabia. MBS has very successfully brought to heel those who might criticize him. So the clerics don't speak out. The business elite don't speak out after hundreds of them were locked in the Ritz-Carlton Hotel. His fellow princes don't speak out. They've either been paid large sums of money to keep quiet, or some of them have been placed under house arrest. So he has this extraordinary degree of consolidated power. I think the biggest threat he faces is the risk of assassination. because he has made an enormous number of enemies on his way to the top.
We've spoken about how the risk to him is potential assassination, and in his own words, he has said that only death could stop him. He's a young man, as we've said, just 38, potentially has decades of rule ahead of him. How significant could his rule, his vision for Saudi Arabia, be for the world? Sebastian, do you want to take that first?
I mean, it's significant in terms that Saudi Arabia has been perhaps the major player in the Middle East for some time now, and that is likely to continue. I mean, whether he has, beyond Saudi Arabia itself, really an ideology, I mean, this is what used to be the case with Saudi Arabia. I mean, the Wahhabi, very strict Islamic ideology was exported to many countries. That certainly isn't going to happen under him. So in some senses, you know, the Saudi effect on the rest of the world might be slightly less in that way. But within the region, as far as most Arab countries are concerned, they need to take Saudi Arabia into account and what it wants. That's going to continue. I mean, the relationship in the wider world, I think, is going to be, as we've seen, not just with Saudi Arabia, but with other countries of a similar kind, which are becoming more and more confident, in a sense, in themselves, politically, socially, and economically, that Saudi Arabia will carve a way for itself, making deals, making agreements, working politically with what the US sees as its enemies, Russia in particular, its economic competitors, China. As things stand, MBS clearly has no concern really about riling the US over this. And I think, you know, that's something that we are going to continue to see.
Jonathan, what do you think?
Well, I think in 10 years' time, MBS is hoping that when he hosts the World Cup, and his country is the only bidder for the 2034 World Cup, it will be a coming out party for his brand of nationalism and for Saudi Arabia having finally taken its place, its rightful place on the world stage as a major power. It's already a G20 country. It's a big economy. MBS has socially, if not politically, liberalized Saudi Arabia. He's made the country a far less stifling place to live. But at the same time, I think he will be up there with President Xi of China and Putin in Russia and Erdogan in Turkey as this diehard economic nationalist. But of course, he's from a new generation. He's still a young man, and he'll be likely ruling Saudi Arabia much longer than those other leaders. So we better get used to him. I think the danger is that he is still unpredictable. He still has a tendency to act on impulse. Whether cooler heads now prevail around him to stop him from making any more mistakes.
Well, plenty to think about there. Thanks to you both for bringing that reporting to us here on The Global Story. Jonathan and Sebastian, thank you.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
And as always, thanks so much to you for listening. If you want to get in touch, please do. You can email us at theglobalstory@bbc.com, or you can send us a message or a voice note on WhatsApp. Our number is +44 330 123 9480. And you can find those details in our show notes. Wherever you're listening in the world, this has been The Global Story. Thank you for having us in your headphones. Bye-bye.
If you enjoyed listening to The Global Story and would like to hear more, there's a new episode every weekday. Just search for The Global Story wherever you get your BBC podcasts and be sure to click subscribe or follow. We'll have another edition of The Global News Podcast later. Until then, goodbye.